In this podcast, we talk about food and body issues. So if you're struggling at the moment, please do consider whether you might want to leave this one for another day. Cake and biscuits and sweet treats in the office can be handy for 11s or combating the 3 o'clock slump. But a blog by Eleanor Bowes says that these sorts of things and other diet and food chatter can be tricky for people with eating problems. This is Inside Ouch. I'm Emma Tracy. With me is Damon Rose. Hello.
Hello.
Beth Rose.
Hello.
And the blog's author, Eleanor Bowes. Hello, Eleanor.
Hi.
You've written a blog about eating problems in the workplace and how people can help those who struggle with those. Why is this subject particularly pertinent to you?
I have a history of eating problems. I am largely recovered now, but I have a lot of friends and a few colleagues that are still really struggling, who find it really difficult to be in the office environment with the food culture that is prevalent probably across most offices. And as someone who had insight into how they were struggling but was kind of looking at it from the outside, I felt like sticking up for them a bit and trying to protect them a little bit by telling people how the way that they behave in the office is can affect them and make things really difficult.
So you say you've recovered now, but what did happen to you? What was your story?
I always had a bit of a issue around food. Like all the way through secondary school, I was either like really restricting or overeating or like sort of binging and stuff. But when I was about 18, I think I started on the course to sort of full-blown bulimia, really. It went from just kind of occasional binge purge cycles, so that means like eating a bunch of food and then getting rid of it. For about 4 years, it kind of ramped up and up and up until I was about 22. It was kind of consumed my life, where I couldn't really be alone without it being what I did, and was really affecting my physical health as well. I was having heart palpitations, I couldn't eat on one side of my mouth, and I was really, really lucky, one in a million lucky, in that I happened to live in the catchment area for a research study that was been done, where they were testing out a new sort of CBT versus a new sort of IBT, so that's cognitive behavioural therapy, and then interpersonal behavioural therapy, which was specifically designed for people with bulimia, and it was really effective, and that kind of set me on my course for recovery. But like, it still flares up. I think that's why we talk about being in recovery, actually, rather than being recovered, is because a lot of us don't ever feel completely recovered. Like, it still is something that we have to deal with, like, on a daily basis.
Is in recovery something you always use?
No, well, I just said in recovered, didn't I, just now? But I suppose it depends on my mood. Sometimes I say I struggle with eating, like, in the present tense, and sometimes I say in recovery. I think when I talk to my friends who are still struggling, I realise how much better I'm doing. So I try and distinguish myself from them a little bit. And that's why I felt able to write this blog, I think. If I was in it at the moment, I don't think I'd be able to do it.
We had someone on the podcast fairly recently talking about her experiences of bulimia. And I hadn't really fully appreciated what binge purge meant. You went through it. How did it manifest itself for you?
Well, it's a compulsive thing, so it's something really hard to control. And it's hard to describe it in too much detail because I don't want to gross people out or trigger someone, because it's not something that is helpful to talk about the detail of. But for me anyway, it was that I dealt with intense feelings through eating huge amounts of food. And the way that I purged was by throwing up, which is a way lots of people do, I think. But there are also other forms of bulimia, which you can do a bunch of exercise. You can eat a lot and then purge it through doing loads of exercise. Or some people just eat a lot one day and then they won't eat for a really long time. So,
And that's another way of purging, not eating for a long time.
Is there any way of kind of balancing out that thing? I mean, I'm not a doctor. I don't know if that's the diagnostic criteria. But the difficulty is as well, and this sort of is why I talk about it as an eating problem rather than eating disorder, because a disorder puts these kind of lines round that if you have these behaviours, you have a disorder, and if you don't. Mm. And it's not that simple, because so many of us have problems or anxieties around food.
And can I ask what's going through your head when you when you're eating lots of food?
Yeah, sure. For me, it was nothing. And that was the point of it, was that I wanted to block out everything that was happening.
But is it about hunger?
No. It can be. It can be triggered by hunger. I would try and restrict. Like, my goal was to not binge and purge. The bit on the surface was that I wanted to lose weight, but obviously it was much more going on about why I wanted to control my food and why it was that method that I chose.
And can you talk about why you wanted to control your
food? I don't think at the time, if I'd had insight into why I was feeling the way I did, I wouldn't have tried to deal with it in such a...
But you were unhappy in some way.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say I'm in recovery from an eating disorder, but I will probably always live with depression, I think, and they are interlinked. I was trying to cope with my depression and anxiety to some extent by... It was a coping mechanism for those things.
And does it happen in an instant moment where you just think, OK, I want that food now? Or does it build up over the day where you think, OK, if I get to 5 o'clock, then I can...
Yeah, it's all
binge.
You think about. Again, for me, it was all I thought about all day. And then it was waiting until I could get alone to...
And was it all hidden? So it was in your bedroom or...?
Yeah, to as much as I could. So of people knew. There was a lot of shame around it. I couldn't accept that people could probably tell what was going on, but I know that people figured it out.
And did they ever say anything to you?
My mum said something to me once and I just dismissed it. And it's really hard to bring up, I think. I thought that everyone would be angry at me and think I was silly, and they weren't. No one was when I did finally tell them.
And did school friends or university friends pick up on it or not?
I didn't have many. Well, I was living with some friends, and I think, yeah, they picked up. One particular one refers to it now. She sort of knew what was going on. But we were all young. We were all going through our own stuff.
Because it's difficult to know whether you should say anything to that person or approach their parents or their siblings. Is there a good way to bring this up with someone if you're a bit worried about a friend or relative?
I think the way that my mum did it was probably good. She was, really sympathetic. But I can't think of a way that I would have said, yeah, that is what's going on. I wasn't ready yet to admit it.
For you, you needed to come to the conclusion yourself that you needed to do something about it.
I had a friend who was struggling with similar things, and I think seeing her made me want to get better for her, almost. Like, doing it for someone else was easier than doing it myself, and seeing her behaviour from outside made me have more insight into how my behaviour wasn't healthy. And I did go to the doctor in my hometown and told them about it, and my doctor told me she was referring me to the specialist, but I just never got anything, never got a letter back. And then I went back to study for a bit longer, and it was only when I went to the doctor in the town I was studying in that I actually got this referral to this eating disorder unit. That first experience is what's typical, and that second experience was, like I said, one in a million lucky.
I mean, even getting to that second experience, it takes a lot of effort and bravery to go once, and then if nothing comes of it, going that second time is harder in a way.
And a lot of people with eating problems don't think they're ill enough for help. That they think it's their fault and they don't deserve help and they should just stop doing what they're doing. But it is compulsive and it's not so easy. You need someone to help you, someone to stop you doing that stuff. And so when you go to the doctor and they don't get back to you, that confirms that.
I think I have a funny relationship with food.
Yeah, I think we all do.
And clothes and body shape and things. For instance, I bought a whole load of clothes off the internet last week, and I'm a bit frightened to put them on. A little bit frightened to put them on. And so I'm going to probably, as I usually do, go past that sort of 14 days before you can return them sort of idea. And, I have that. And I also have problems with I don't know, foods and textures and things like that. I'm not suggesting I've got any kind of big difficulties or anything, but I'm just interested in the anatomy of bulimia. What's the difference between me, somebody who's got a fairly... I don't know, day-to-day, regular kind of anxiety about food and weight versus you. Are there particular foods, for instance, that caused you a problem when you were at the height of your bulimia?
I think that, as like with any mental health issue, it's a spectrum, and I don't think there is anything that separates you from me. Some people are going to be completely, don't understand why anyone has any issue with food, and there's going to be some people on the other end that are, you know, in hospital or fighting for their lives because of their feelings around food. And at any time in our lives, we might be on one end or the other end of the spectrum. I think that's why I try and talk about it as an eating problem rather than this some distinct issue that is some sort of disorder.
And are there particular foods that that bother you?
When I was really unwell, if I ate anything really that was very high calorie or bad food, so crisps or chocolate or cake or chips or those things that are considered bad in the media or in our kind of interactions with each other, that would trigger. So if I'd eaten one bad thing, then that would just trigger a whole... I might as well just eat everything now. Like, I wanted everything. It was, you know, all or nothing, really.
You mentioned high-calorie foods, is there? Yeah. So are you... I wonder if you're a bit like me. Do you know the calories of foods? How many calories in a boiled egg?
I don't eat eggs, so...
How many calories in a banana? It's about 90 in a boiled egg.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we probably shouldn't talk about that on a programme about eating problems, because that's quite triggering for people, I think.
Do you think so?
Yeah, I know so.
Well, I think we could definitely put a trigger warning, and we would do at the beginning of the programme anyway.
The thing about calorie counting or any sort of measuring food, weighing food, it is that falling off the wagon, isn't it? So once you've eaten that brownie or whatever, you just think, oh, well, you know, might as well have a glass of wine now.
Definitely. When you're trying to recover from an eating problem, you're deprogramming yourself from that idea of bad foods and good foods and good bodies and bad bodies. But then when you face back out into the real world, like, i.e. the workplace, you have to face those things again. And when people come at you with those things that you've just taken, you know, a year to deprogram yourself out of, it gets quite frustrating.
Recent figures say that 1 in 20 people might be dealing with an eating problem. Mm. So, you know, there's going to be a few in every workplace.
Exactly.
So what can we do or not do that might help them not feel stressed about coming into work around so much food and food talk?
Some of it's about culture change in an office. And so I'm trying to remember back to my...
Beth has
I'm trying to read it across the desk.
So, yes, you've written this blog, which gives the six things, mm-hmm. and they're all related to workplaces, and we can see our workplace in there very clearly. So the first one is... Don't organise social activities solely based around food, drink or exercise, which basically everything to do with work is always arranged around. And you mentioned about how if you don't feel you can take part in that, you then feel really antisocial.
Yeah, we're not little snowflakes that want to be, like, everything changed just for us. Like, we get that that's what most people do. It's just that there's been experiences I've had in workplaces where, you know, we're all going to the park and we're going to play some games and stuff and do some running about and all that kind of stuff. And I've had, like, management come at me and say, you have to come. It's like, it's forced fun. But I know there's been people I work with that's set them back, like, weeks.
I mean, it always does go back to let's go for drinks or let's go for a meal. Mm-hmm. So if that is... the option, that's what your team has decided, is there strategies around it so that you can prepare yourself?
One of her friends said that if we're going out for a lunch or dinner, she wants to know where we're going in advance so she can look at the menu and kind of plan what she's going to eat. A really difficult part of going out for dinner is choosing what you're going to eat, so she can think in advance and then she doesn't have to do that whole thing. She can just know and she can just ask straight away. The other point is that, yeah, carry on doing all that stuff. That's not going to change. But don't pressurise, especially if you're managing someone who is struggling with that stuff. Well, you might not know that they're struggling with that stuff. Don't try and force them to go.
Mm. Finding out in advance where we're going for the meal, that kind of leads on to point two, which is food choices. Mm. People are always commenting on everybody else's food choices all the time. What's the problem with that and what can we do differently? Just not do it.
Well, it's the fact that you're trying to deprogram yourself, that anyone cares what you're eating and that it's important, your choice. Like I said to Beth just now, like, my whole day would be about what I was going to eat when I got home, whether it was going to be like to make myself feel better, or it was whether it was going to be to try and stop myself from going through that cycle again, the binge purge cycle. Everything was about the choice of the food. So you're just trying to like relax a bit about it and just be like, I'm just going to have a sandwich. Like everyone else, people just grab a sandwich from the shop on the way in, like get a meal deal or whatever. And then when you've trying to relax and not think about it, and someone comes along and goes like, oh, is that all you're having? Or, yeah. Oh, I hate tuna, how can you eat it? Something like that. Like, it confirms you, what you're trying to fight against, is that it's important what you're eating, and other people are looking at you, judging what you're eating. Like, once I know someone and I know that it's okay for me to, like, talk about it, then I will comment, but don't go commenting on like strangers' food. Like, yeah. No one asked you.
So like in the queue, yeah, like in the queue to pay or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also you probably comment positively on food rather than...
Yeah. But then even positive stuff. Like I remember someone saying to me, I worked in a school and someone said to me, oh, it's so nice to see someone your age eating so well, Ellie. And that stuck with me. That's like 12 years ago now.
You still remember
and
it.
And I still remember it because I was like, oh, she thinks I eat loads. I think I was having like a jacket potato or something.
Yeah, but it's
so
just...
she meant it positively, but I took it. And yeah. I think that's sometimes when you're in that state of mind, anything anyone says is going to be a negative thing.
And your third point in your blog is ditto exercise. Mm-hmm. And that's become a real thing in the office, hasn't it? Everyone's running a marathon every other weekend, or they've got their Fitbits, or they're trying yoga, or all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying never do it. I'm not trying to be preachy and like saying you're all doing it wrong all the time. It's just that, just be mindful of it. Just take a few moments to think about what you're saying and like stop evaluating yourself as well, saying like, oh, I haven't been to the gym for like weeks, I'm so naughty, or isn't that bad? I had a bit of exercise issues over the years, but like not really. I hate it. But there's people I know that it is a real issue for them, like, and just take a minute to think about what you're saying.
It's a lot about being mindful of others and some common sense, isn't it? Think of what's going on for the people in their lives before you start moaning about not having a toned belly or whatever.
Yeah, I think it's something that comes along with eating issues often, is a lot of people have, it's called body dysmorphia to some extent. Some people have it much worse than others, where you see your body very differently from how others see it, or you feel grotesque to like varying degrees depending on the day. How often do you walk around to see people and think, oh, we all just have really normal bodies, it's all good?
It's funny how much that feeling grotesque thing is in your head, isn't it? Because you may not look grotesque, as whatever that means. The weirdest days for me, I suppose, are when I do feel grotesque. And then I go home and weigh myself and I'm about 6 pounds lighter than I thought I was.
Yeah.
And then I feel a bit better.
You look lovely, Damon.
Oh, thank you very much.
Your next one is, I don't know what people call it, but in our office it's known as It Up, which is in the usual place. Somewhere else I worked, it was known as the food altar. Other places are like the usual place, the end of the desk. And I'm talking about that one location where sweets and treats and cakes appear what seems to be constantly now. And the round robin email saying, hey guys, I'm back from holiday, there's a whole load of sweets, come and help yourself.
It's interesting that you're saying that it seems to be really bad now, because I think it's really ramped up in our office as well, which is one of the things that got me to write this blog. And so I wonder what it is that like everyone's going up on it.
Your point is, be mindful of bringing treats into the office.
Yeah.
And I mean, even the NHS has given out warnings now saying, you know, people are looking after themselves to a point, and then the treats culture.
And I think it's almost like a macro version of that binge purge cycle that I was really struggling with, is where you think so much that you need to eat good foods at this time and you know, be this ideal version of yourself in terms of diet and exercise. And most of us can't live up to that. And so you restrict so much to the extent that you're just like, I'm just going to buy a big bag of donuts for the office. And then you share it with everyone else, so it makes you feel more like you can share the guilt around the office a little bit. If you're trying to concentrate on work, which is why you're at work, you're trying to do your job and be good at it, and there's you can see in your eyeliner is just a pile of biscuits. You're just not going to be able to concentrate if you're obsessed with food, which people with my experience can be. You're just going to be like, biscuits, biscuits, biscuits. So just all your reports will just be biscuits over and over again. So some of the things we're trying to make a compromise is like maybe just keep it in the kitchen. You know, you expect to find food in the kitchen, and if you're struggling that day, maybe you can just avoid going in there, or you can prepare yourself to go in there. Don't have them in like in the walkway. So this is from someone who I spoke to. Every time you have to walk past, it's just really hard to not just be like, take it. And then also, if you're going to bring biscuits in, maybe bring in a bunch of grapes in or some satsumas or something, just so there's that option. And I'm sure even people without any problems would appreciate that.
But summing all this up, I mean, it feels like basic common courtesy in a lot of ways, doesn't it? You shouldn't really comment on somebody's food. Oh, you've got jam sandwiches. Oh, I haven't had those since I was a kid. Or, you know, oh, you got turkey. Oh, you think it's Christmas. Or saying to someone, are you going to the gym again today? That kind of thing. I mean, just commenting on people like that anyways isn't particularly pleasant, is it? It's personal.
Yeah, I think so. And I think sometimes what you're saying when you say those things, you're talking about your own feelings, really.
The other thing you mentioned as well is try to avoid diet chat, Damon.
I mean, I do remember in the past Emma coming into the office and she would get something out to eat, and I'd say something like, you do know that's 600 calories, don't you?
That happened a lot.
Ouch.
That happened. It's not funny.
No, it's not funny. I'm embarrassed. That's why I'm laughing.
And especially when you were on like the 5-2 diet. You see, now we're talking about diets. You see, this is a problem, right? We're doing it.
Yeah.
But we're doing it in an informed way.
Yeah,
we're analysing it.
Yeah.
Yes, we're analysing it.
Like, yeah, it's not that you could never talk about a diet again, but just so often you can have people you can hear in the back behind you, like just 20-minute conversations about beach diets or wedding diets, or
and it's the repetition.
Yeah.
So that one person will tell five different colleagues at five different times. Yeah. In one day.
And it's probably because they're so hungry. They just really all they can think about.
Or
that's not a good way to be.
Or that they have an eating problem themselves.
Yeah.
That's what's starting to strike me, is that sometimes the people who really are pushing it forward might have food issues of their own. And, you know,
that's a really good point.
It's tricky.
I come to it from the perspective that I'm actually generally kind of interested in health, and the fact that you know, those brownie bars that you get in the coffee shop on the seventh floor here are 550 calories. Goodness me. You know, people sort of, it's people need to know this.
Like, as I said, I struggle with depression. If I wake up really low, thinking back to what I ate the last day, that can make me feel better or worse, depending on what it was. So if I know that I'd, you know, stuck to a kind of three meals a day, you know, good stuff, and I wake up in the morning, that can be what makes it easier to get out of bed. But if I think back and I've had a bad day, the next day will be a bad day as well. Mm. And that shouldn't be that way. I know that's my disordered thinking coming back.
Because your final point in the blog, or the final point for now, I guess it could expand, is that you need to acknowledge that healthy means different things to different people. Mm. So someone eating a bag of crisps could actually be a really big victory for them.
Mm-hmm. I had an office once where they had a wall of healthy lunches, and I really wanted to, but I couldn't. I was too shy, wanted to put my chips on there, because this is what's healthy for me, guys. Like, I need to not restrict too much, because otherwise those behaviours return. I need to not think about food as in good and bad, because otherwise that's what keeps me healthy. But we're all under a lot of pressure to eat the right things and do the most amount of activity. And I know that a lot of those messages are really well-meaning and are trying to increase the health of people, but they're just not quite grasping how different people are and how different people read different messages and respond to things. If we really want to make people healthier, there are other ways than, you know, public awareness campaigns. Like, that 500 calorie brownie bar probably shouldn't be available. I'm not a government health specialist, but it's quite superficial the way that some people approach it.
Thank you so much for joining us, Eleanor Bowes, and talking about your own experiences with food and your blog about eating problems and the workplace.
No problem.
And thanks to Damon Rose.
Thank you.
And Beth Rose.
Thank you.
This has been Inside Out. I'm Emma Tracy. If you want to see more of our stuff, go to bbc.co.uk/disability. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at bbcouch. Email us with any thoughts or story suggestions to ouch@bbc.co.uk.